This is the second day of June 2010. And we'll resume working on the paramitas, but before we get into them, let me say a few words about breath practice. Breath practice is usually assigned to people who begin practice. And therefore, sometimes people see it just as a simple stepping stone to their practice. And it's not that so. When I started practicing, I went to my first 4-day sesshin in Mexico with Roshi Kaplo, and of course I had heard of koans and how important it was to become someone if you had a koan. And so I told Roshi and insisted twice. I was given a koan. So I didn't have much of an experience about breath practice until later. Going through a number of books of koans, I went back to breath practice. I was amazed at how much it offered. So it's not just it's not just a beginning practice. It's a practice that the Buddha was doing when he had his supreme enlightenment. Has had to offer. Is by following the breath, we're dropping everything. Everything. We just count the breath. We use counting as a way of like an anchor for the mind. We won't wander so easily. We simply experience the breath as it comes in and goes out. And we learn how to go back to the practice. The breath is always with us. It's always with us. We can always go back to the breath. as soon as we realize we are distracted or thinking of something else. Just to follow the breath or to count the breath is to learn how to leave everything behind and just concentrate on the practice. That's what's important about breath practice. It's just dropping everything. Koan work, as a contrast, has a sense of direction, a sense of achieving something. That breath practice does not have. Once you get into this mind state of, I'm gonna get it now, and of course that's the first obstacle. This machine is the good one. I'm going to do it in this machine. It's a good determination. But then you have to drop it. Let it go. Because there's the danger of making our practice, this machine is the one. And that's not a practice. That's an obstruction. With mu or who or what is it, what we want is just simply to be in that practice as well as with breath. Practice especially in breath practice is simply a process practice. There's no meaning to breathing. We do it all the time. We know how to do it. Learning is not to breathe. The learning is to only breathe. Like any other activity, say you're going to run in a competition to get $1 million as a prize, and it's a benefit prize, it's going to go to a noble cause, and that inspires you to run. But the training itself, that might keep you training. But training itself is just the running. The race is just a race. You can't practice thinking, here it comes. Here it is. It becomes a huge obstruction. Must be able to just simply practice. As hard as you can, as much as you can, but just doing it. No expectations of gain and law and laws. Because those get in the way. It's a hindrance. Before going into the next paramita, allow me to read a couple of pages of Huihai, the great teachers, talking about the first paramita, Dana Paramita. And the question, this is a book called The Zen Teachings of Huihai, and it's in a question and answer format. And the question is, by what means can the gateway of our school be entered? Answer: by means of the Dana Paramita. Question: according to the Buddha, Sattva path comprises six paramitas. Why then have you mentioned only one? Please explain why this one alone provides a sufficient means for us to enter. Deluded people fail to understand that the other five all proceed from the Dana Paramita, and that by its practice all the others are fulfilled. It's similar to the precepts in which it is said that the first one not to kill but to cherish all life is the central one, the rest are derivations or come from that one. Question, why is it called the Dana Paramita? Answer, Dana means relinquishment. Question, relinquishment of what? Relinquishment of the dualist, the dualism of oppositions, which means total relinquishment of ideas as to the dual nature of good and bad, being and not non-being, love and aversion, void and non-void, concentration and distraction, pure and impure. By giving all of them up, we attain to a state in which all opposites are seen as void. The real practice of the Dana Paramita entails achieving the state without a thought of, now I see that opposites are void, or now I have relinquished all of them. It's quite obvious that we can't go around saying, no, okay, I have no opposites in me. Now I have relinquished all of them. We may also call it the simultaneous cutting off of the myriad types of concurrent causes, for it is when these are cut off that the whole Dharma nature becomes void. This simultaneous cutting of all the myriad types of concurrent causes, karma, in short. And this voidness of the Dharma nature means the non-dwelling of the mind upon anything whatsoever. Once that state is achieved, not a single thing, not a single form can be discerned. Why? Because our self nature is immaterial and does not contain a single thing. That which contains no single thing is true reality, the marvelous form of the Tathagata. It is said in the Diamond Sutra, those who relinquish all forms are called Buddhas. Letting go of all the opposites. Yesterday we spoke of the highest, the most difficult giving is the giving of ourselves. In order to let go all the opposites, we need to let go of all the goods and bads that others have done to us and we have done to others. And it's usual, even though sometimes it seems clear, but we forget to distinguish between forgiveness and condone. Forgiveness is the inner process. It's an inner process. I forgive. And by that, we can break the karmic links to the circumstances. If the other person did something wrong, some kind of retribution will come. But that's his problem. Our problem is to forgive. We cannot change other people. We can only change ourselves. I would love to change all of you, have you all enlightened. Now I declare you all, and you're all enlightened. I would love to do that, but it doesn't happen that way. I don't have that kind of power. No one does, at least that I know of. Each one is responsible of the process of forgiving inside themselves. Whatever happens to the others, it's a mystery. Be great if we could. We change ourselves. We open the gateways for others to have more room, more space to change as well. It's extremely difficult to change oneself when someone else is blaming us and pointing fingers at us. It's extremely difficult because we are locked in our position. So if we are able to forgive and stop blaming other people or pointing fingers at other people, it helps other people to also move. We don't know if the other person is going to change or not. We don't know it. We just hope that the person can change. But there are no guarantees. But if I change, if I let go, I can cut the bud of karmic retributions for causing pain to others, or to live myself in pain for whatever reason there is. There's an underlying issue in this Isshin, and certain people have brought it up in Doksan. Kind of a sitting issue in the Zendo and some people of the Sangha. Not everyone, but some it is. And I can only speak about it from my own experience. So let me just simply say a few words about that. The issue of relationship between people in power, teachers, and students. After my first session, when I got my koan, I mentioned earlier, I was happy coming out, finally finished the pain of legs, knees. I still hold the record for the most cushions in Mexico. 13 cushions. I had built a pyramid. And there was another person next to me that each cushion I would add, she would add one, and exactly the same. She thought I knew something about cushion technique, which I didn't. But because she followed me, in the last round I put one more, got the first place. One cushion here, one cushion there. And of course, I would end up falling, slipping down in this pile, and end up with a terrible posture of my back being crooked, my knees over there, and a monitor saying, no moving. No moving. So, session ends and I walk out, and we were in Mexico 4 days, and I started practicing because my first wife was practicing. She was a member of the Sangha. In Mexico, it was a very small sangha, and I simply became part of the friends of the sangha. I wasn't interested in sitting. It was a nice bunch of people, and became friends of the spouses of the other members, and she came to one session, and I was curious why she's sitting. Why does she get up at 5 in the morning to sit, or 6 in the morning to sit for 1 hour looking at the wall? And she came to session, and I felt I had to find out and kind of be a supportive by sitting myself. She was in session, I felt it would help. And so that's what I did. And I had heard enough. I had no formal instruction. And I just simply sat as best as I could. My knees were up here. So I sat, and then I began sitting, and when session in Mexico came, I told Roshi, and here I'll be, when I mention Roshi, it's Roshi Kaplo. I told Roshi Kaplo that I wanted to go to session. Said, well, sure. Have you practiced? Well, I've been sitting for a while. I told him, and well, okay. So a week, Sesshin, long story. We come out of Sesshin, and there was a swimming pool, small swimming pool, and we throw the monitor into the pool. There should be a pool here. We could do that. The pond, fishing winter, and some of us, of course, fell in as well. Part of the fun. And I went to change clothes. And when I come back, my wife is sitting next to the main monitor, head monitor, on the side of the pool, splashing with her feet and holding hands. That's strange. That's something I didn't know some people did. And later on I learned that they were having an affair. And of course we started a divorce. And after divorce, she went to live with him in Santa Fe. I was in quite a shock, as you can imagine. And I kept on sitting because I found that by sitting, I could stop crying. It eased the pain. The sitting eased the pain. The sitting helped me. So I kept sitting. Of course, all this was extremely painful. And of course, all the questions of how could this happen? Isn't he the second in command? Hasn't he gone through con work for years? And I never told Roshi. Someone in the Sangha told him that Martha, my first wife, she and I were not living together, and therefore it was okay. So Roshi felt it was okay. He never asked me. I never told him. Was there a sense of competition with this other guy? Yes, undoubtedly. I wouldn't recognize it then, but and say today, yes. Was I trying to prove I was superior? Yes. Was ego involved? Yes. Yes. It was. My part. But also I had been hooked by the practice. found that helped me was an oasis in the dramas. And I kept sitting. I applied to my first sesshin, of course, was rejected, which I'm grateful for. Because it would have been difficult to have someone using the stick behind me whom I didn't feel too comfortable with at that moment. And then I did come to a first sesshin to Rochester. Five-day. And then I started my own practice. With time, therapy, I rebuilt myself. I was able to forgive Marta and Sinson what had happened. Mary remarried and just simply let go. Forgive them. Forgive what had happened as a way of freeing myself of the circumstances. The karmic bond of the relationship. They kept on with their own life. They split later on, 8 months later or 10 months later, can't remember. Sinson became the teacher of the Toronto group, and later left it. I was asked to leave. And Marta kept on with her life. Her relationships. But here I am now. With what seemed like impossible in those days, it's a deep faith in practice. I know it works. It's worked for me. It's worked for me, and it still continues to work for me. Convinced by my own experience that Zen is my life. I'm also convinced of the power of forgiving as a way of ending the karmic ties. That hatred, resentment, regrets bring. Have I asked myself, should I have told Roshi that yes, we were married, that why did this guy come and take my wife away. I don't know. Would I have avoided pain to others? I don't know. Should I have done this? Should I have done that? I don't know. I did what I felt was right at that moment. And karma catches up with people. Yes, it does. Avoided more pain? Maybe. I don't know. I only know I could change myself. I know I could only practice myself. In that light, when I see other people wondering about Sevan, about Kathy, about Caroline, about their own practice, just simply would say, it's your practice. Don't use what others have done. To destroy your own practice. Or not to engage, or not to fully give yourself into the practice. Give yourself fully into the practice. Don't project on others and the deeds of others what belongs to you, your own doubts and insecurities about your practice. It works. Zen works. I know it. I just hope that Kathy can forgive in her inner heart and drop the anger, the resentment that all this has brought. Hope Caroline can do the same, heal herself, drop her disappointments, her anger, her resentment. And to the Sangha in general, the very faith that the teachers that are now responsible for the Sangha in Chicago will do the utmost to live up to the teaching. It has also shaken their own sense of I doing with this teaching? And to seven, a brother Dharma, Dharma brother. He has lost what he most cherished. I truly hope that he can work through his own karmic disabilities that caused this drama in the first place. Is it a big issue? Is it a small issue? Is it this? Is it that? I don't know. What I do know is each one of us has to work out his own karma. And you know from experience that is possible. It is possible. It can be done. It's painful, yes. It is painful, yes. It hurts, yes. One questions, yes, one questions. But through practice, one can cut the seeds of this negative karma for oneself, and hopefully it'll help others as well. Yes, it is painful for myself to see what has happened. Hurts me even more when we get into a game of blaming each other. That doesn't help. And judging, that doesn't help. Of questioning the practice. Why would a teacher do that? Why have so many teachers and stupid things? Well, I don't know why these karmic forces suddenly blossom and destroy and forces us to see the issues we haven't seen. Use the circumstances. Use them to see into your own self that none of us fall into an issue of abusing the power given to us by others, the trust given to us by others, in our families, in our jobs, in our relationships, as our Dharma brothers and sisters. Look deeply into yourself. We all are given power as parents, as friends. What do we do with that power? In our own sphere of influence, what do? Is the trust of others towards ourselves. Do we go yelling at them, blaming them for things? Do we open up have revisited the beginning of my practice in the light of what's happening. And I work on myself to avoid the issues that caused it. Like to end this teisho thanking my own biography, Martha Sensen, for forcing me to see what I had to see. Was it skillful? No. Would I have preferred another way? Yes. That's the way it happened. And to invite each one of you, take it at heart to review what each one of you is doing with the power others have given you. The trust others have given you. Your family, friends, work, Dharma heirs, Dharma friends. Take a good look. You might be able to cut things. Karma seeds in the bud before such a vine that tears down the forest. Learn to forgive. Learn to forgive. It takes practice, lots of practice, but it's very useful to bringing down the ego. To see that I am not always right, or that I am responsible for part of it. He called me an idiot. Yes, well, what did I call him back? When am I responsible for responding in a non-skillful way? We'll end up here and have the four vowels.